everyone, and welcome. We're going to be exploring Megillas Rus, the book story of Ruth, one of the best known of the biblical stories, but one that has so many layers of meaning. Now, the book of Ruth itself is a four-chapter work. We read it every year on Shavuos, on the festival that commemorates the receiving of Torah. And the reasons are given, first of all, because Ruth is a convert, and we ourselves became, so to speak, converts, or not so to speak, we converted nationally on Shavuos, so we commemorate that by reading the story of a convert. We receive the Torah, she received the Torah. Also, the fact that the word Shavuos, the festival that commemorates receiving Torah, the word means weeks, the festival of weeks, because of the seven-week count leading up to it from Pesach to Shavuos. And those 7 weeks commemorate the beginning of the barley season, the barley harvest in Israel, which starts on the second day of Pesach, all the way up to the beginning of the wheat harvest, Shavuos. And those 7 weeks are where the major events of the story happen. Chapters 2, 3, and 4 literally begin at the end of chapter 1 is the beginning of the barley season. So literally these Shavuos, these 7 weeks leading to the festival of Shavuos, are when the main episodes take place. But also because the book ends with the birth of David. Ruth is a convert who joins the Jewish people and ends up becoming the great-grandmother of royalty, of King David, and later all the Davidic lineage, all the way to the Mashiach, to the Messiah at the end of history. And the book ends with the fact, with the word David. He's going to be born. And his death and birth are both Shavuos. So there's so many links, but how do we thread these pieces together? And here we have an amazing thing. The Medrash tells us, the ancient rabbinic commentary, the Rus Rabbah, uses the following expression. It says in Rus Rabbah 2:14 that this Megillah does not contain lo tumah v'lo tahara, not any laws of purity and impurity, no issa v'heta, no laws of what's permitted or forbidden. The whole book is to teach you the reward for chesed, for loving kindness. Okay, so you'd say, well, who's against loving kindness? Well, it turns out lots of people are. And in fact, the entire Megillah takes place in the background of a struggle between loving kindness and not that. What could be wrong with loving kindness? Why would anybody oppose it? Well, let's first of all just look at the beginning, because the Megillah itself opens with the following words. Vayehi bimei shvoit ha-shoftim, it was in the days the judges judged. And by the way, a good clue to analyzing any biblical text is how does it open and how does it close? It goes from the days the judges judged, the centuries before there was a monarchy, before ancient Israel was one nation under one single political leader, while it was kind of a tribal confederacy, and the days of the judges, that's what it's called. The book of Shoftim, the book of Judges, depicts this era. And it ends with the introduction of David, the man who will unify the nation under a monarchy. And therefore, you would expect that as a transitional work, it's going to involve political philosophy. And shockingly enough, it doesn't. The entire story is a book about love and relationship and loyalty and integrity and all these between three main characters. And we're going to explore all that. But it means that the transformation of a nation does not take place because you've got a great political system. The ability to create the right type of nation depends on the ability to rectify relationships between very different types of people, representing different types of backgrounds. And we're going to see the issues that underlie this. It's like if you can get the relationships between cells right, then you can build a human body. But if those relationships are not working, you can never build. Doesn't matter how great your vision is, the whole thing, the whole society will keep collapsing. And in fact, we begin the book in a state of societal collapse, captured brilliantly in several literary devices in the opening passage, the opening verse, two psukim, two verses of the whole book. It says, "Vayehi bimei shvoit ha-shoftim." Number one, it was in the days the judges judged. Now, ostensibly, that ought to be locating the story in time. But it turns out to be a pretty useless temporal device, because the days the judges judged spans centuries. It's like saying it was in the days there were kings of England. Thank you. There were lots of them, right? Are you trying to pick a time? And the rabbis say there's another meaning to this. Shavuot HaShoftim is ambiguous. It could also be read the days they judged their judges. Say the rabbis, the Talmud, before the judge would say to you, take that toothpick out of your mouth. You'd say to the judge, well, take that house beam out of your eyes. It's an Aramaic phrase that's lost in translation there. But what it means is either there was genuine accusing being of hypocrites, basically, that they were accusing the judges of hypocrisy, of being hypocrites. Either they were correct or they were hypercritical. But either there's hypercriticism or genuine hypocrisy, right? Both of them, either one is a disaster. There's a breakdown in the moral order between those who should be leading the nation and being the moral authorities and the masses. Number two, Vayhi Ra'av Ba'aretz, there is now economic breakdown. Famine. Number three, social breakdown. It says, Vayedach ish Beis Lechem Yehuda, a man leaves the town of Beis Lechem in Judea, who he, it doesn't say his name, just a man. And in fact, the rabbis tell us, ish, right, the Medrash Tanchuma in Bamidbar says that ish means a nobleman. So a nobleman from the town of Beis Lechem in Judea, Bethlehem nowadays, leaves together with his wife. Why is he not giving us names? And his two children. And then the next verse says, oh, and by the way, the name, Elimelech, he's called Elimelech, she's called Naomi, Machlon, Kilion. And Rabbi Miller quotes this idea that this device of anonymity, a man, a nobleman, and his wife means, this could have been about anybody. This is like a schematic sentence. You could insert any of the nobility into this verse. The entire nobility is leaving town. The noble are leaving. It happens to be we are particularly focused on one family, but this could have been anybody. In other words, when the famine strikes, the nobility are leaving. Now, two problems. Where are they going to? They're going to Moab. Two problems. One, why are the nobility leaving? Poor people might want to run away because there's a shortage of food, but the wealthy landowners have grain storages. They don't have a shortage of food. But number two, if there's a problem in Bethlehem, in Beis Lechem, in Bethlehem, Moab is only on the other side. It's the east bank of the River Jordan, right? It's the land of Jordan today. Beis Lechem is on what's called the west bank of the River Jordan. They're very near each other. If there's a famine in one, there's probably a famine in the other. Now, it's true there's slightly better crop yields on the east bank than the west bank because precipitation from the River Jordan. But it's not massively significant. If there's real famine in one, there's probably going to be famine in the other. So what's happening here? And here we begin to understand something. Moab is a familiar culture and civilization biblically. They're criticized in the Torah, in the Book of Devarim, Book of Deuteronomy, that we're told that you can't even let Moabite men, even if they convert, they shouldn't marry into the Jewish people. Because they were anti-kindness. When the Israelites were wandering in the desert and were willing to pay for food, they were the civilization that said, no way, we refuse to sell you anything. We refuse to let you have water. We don't believe food, water. We don't believe in charity. We don't believe in kindness. Now, we have to know, where on earth does that ideology come from? We'll get there. But first, let's note this. The nobility were not short of food. The nobility had a problem. Everybody wants charity. When the famine strikes, the world wants charity, wants kindness, and the nobility of this town did not want to deliver. So we have a moral breakdown, the judges are being judged. We have the economic breakdown, there's a famine, and we have the social fabric breakdown. The rich don't want to look after the poor. They want to get out and go to the culture that is known for not caring for the needy. That's what's happening here. Now, why is Moab that way? Well, it turns out that this cultural attitude has antecedent roots in an old biblical culture called Sodom. Sodom are in the book of Genesis, the book of Bereishis. They are the kind of arch enemy or antagonistic rivals of Abraham. Abraham and Sarah build an ideology based on kindness, chesed, loving kindness. And they had a nephew who they raised to be the heir to their movement, and his name is Lot. And at a key moment, Lot leaves them. And he goes to the town of Sodom. And Sodom is a place so anti-kindness that whenever the Talmud wants to depict or talk about the character traits of somebody who refuses to give to someone else, even when they don't lose out, or someone who says, Shali, Shali, whatever's mine is mine, it uses the word Midas Sodom, the attribute of Sodom, the anti-kindness, compassion, civilization. Again, how can anybody be anti-kindness? And here's the idea. Here's the idea. In the biblical story, we see it because when the strangers who are angels dressed looking like humans come to town and Lot takes them into his house, the natives of Sodom bash down the door. They literally want to abuse the strangers and they're saved only by miracle. They hate the idea of caring about strangers. Now, you should know there's one other Torah story this way. We've got to get into it. Why is anybody going to be like this? What's going on? And how does this connect to Moab? Well, first I'll tell you how it connects to Moab, then I'll tell you the other biblical story, and then we'll go into why they will be this way, and what that means for us, because it raises, actually they have a very powerful challenge they're going to raise against the concept of kindness. Where's the link to Moab and Sodom? When Sodom is destroyed in the book of Genesis, the book of Bereshit, Lot and his daughters end up running into a cave, and they are convinced the world has been destroyed. And they feel they have no choice but to rebuild. Lot's daughters get their father drunk, and then they have a child through him, and the first child is called Moab, literally means from the father. So the nation of Moab is the derivative culture of the anti-kindness civilization of Sodom. And that civilization is the backdrop of this story. They're maintaining the same trait, anti-kindness, and when the rich from the town of Bethlehem don't want to give charity, they go to the place of anti-kindness, Moab, the derivative culture of Sodom. And so we have a lot of clues that the background issues here are going to link all the way back into the book of Genesis, back into the book of Bereshit, into Sodom. Another important clue that we're linking the same themes comes from the final chapters of the book of Judges. Remember, Ruth Rus opens with the word, it was the days the judges judged. That links us straight back to the end of the book of Judges, the end of the book of Shoftim. And in the book of Judges, there is a tragic final episode, very reminiscent of Sodom, called the Pilegesh Begiva, the concubine of Giva. A man travels through the Benjaminite, the Binyamin areas of the land, ends up in a town called Giva. Nobody will take him in as a guest. He travels with a concubine woman. Okay, shouldn't have had that type of relationship, but that's a small detail of the story. Everyone refuses to offer hospitality except one old member of the town, brings him in, and just like Sodom, the town members gather, smash the door down, want to abuse the man, end up taking the concubine. By the morning, she has been so badly abused that she dies. He is livid. He chops her body up and does something horrific, sends body parts to each of the tribes of Israel to say, look what's going on. One thing leads to another, and basically a civil war erupts as the tribes come to enact justice. Thousands of people are killed. The tribe of Benjamin is almost totally destroyed. And the book of Judges, the book of Shoftim, ends with this kind of story, and then ends with the words, Bayomim, in those days, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there's no king of Israel. Ish HaYashav Ein Av Yaaseh, everybody did what is straight in their eyes. Boom. Like the great critique of this, if we leave everyone to their own devices, what happens? We need to change this. And here we have the book of Ruth. It was the days the judges judged. Let's watch how this transition happens. So this is where, in ancient Israel, Jews themselves, or Benjaminites, part of the nation of Israel, had become Sodom-like. They'd become like Moabites. They'd become like this anti-kindness world. It had gone into the fabric of our society. It was a tragedy. And this book opens in a very similar scenario. The nobility want the anti-kindness world. Why is there so much pursuit of anti-kindness? What's going on? And this is going to be critical for the whole Shavuos, because Shavuos is about the greatest act of kindness that ever happened, other than creation itself. Creation is the purest act of giving. If there's a problem with kindness, there's going to be a problem in our relationship with the infinite loving Creator. And Shavuos is when the Creator says, I offer you a pathway to eternity. I offer you, connect to my own will. I offer you my Torah. And if there's a problem with kindness and a reason to run away, there'll be a problem with Shavuos. So let's explore what's going on over here. But you see clearly, the opening verses are clearly throwing all this at us. The moral breakdown, the economic breakdown, and the disastrous social breakdown when the Israelites, linking back to the story when the Benjaminites wanted to become like Sodom and Moab, and entering here when the wealthy of the town want to go and be like Moab, this whole thing is clearly the shadow of this story. Let's go back to where we meet its origin, its antecedent, back in the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. Lot leaves Avram, and the verse that opens that section says, "Vegamla lo ta'olech Avram," and also Lot. What's happened in the story is Avram and Sarah, Abram and Sarah, they arrived in Canaan, as God said, travel to the land which will become Israel. This is the land your descendants will inherit. And then there's a famine in the land, similar to here, but unlike, they don't go to the East Bank where this climate's the same, they go all the way down to Egypt where there's rivers and it's less affected by the rains. And Pharaoh, a whole story happens there. They end up leaving with tremendous wealth. I'm not going into all details now, just because, I mean, it's an important story, but we'll just get too sidetracked. But either way, as they return with tremendous wealth. This is the Gamlelite in chapter 13, verse 5. The Gamlelite Hailechas Avram, Hayatsoinu Bakavai Halim. Also to Lot, who went with Abraham, he had a lot of wealth too. And you think, one second, what's that? And also to Lot. Just say, Lot, you know, there's blessing to this one, this one, this one. The Abar Benel commentator says, no. What's going on over here is it's emphasizing how Lot is really Mr. Also. He and Rashi even says, what caused him to have this wealth, right? These are different commentaries, is the fact that he was with Avram. That's what the Torah is emphasizing. This was not self-made Lot. This is Lot who has gone, who's Mr. Also in the relationship with Abraham, with Avram. And that is giving us the clue as to why then a few verses later he says, I can't stay with you. I've got to go to Sodom. Why? Why would the man who's been raised by Avraham and Sarah, whose motto is loving kindness, whose relationship with God is look at God of loving kindness, who opened their tent to everybody in a world of loving kindness, who've raised this boy who was an orphan and lost, and they raised him in acts of loving kindness, and have built him up and given everything, why would he leave and go to their nemesis? And this is where Rabbi Weinberg and Rabbi Miller say it beautifully. That's exactly why. Lot turns to his uncle and aunt and says, do you know what? Do you know how much you've killed me with your kindness? You have smothered me. It may have been nice when I'm a little kid, but I'm an adult now and still the recipient of kindness. Do you know what it feels like to be the recipient of kindness? Do you know how humiliating it is? Does anybody like to be a charity case? This amazing thing, we use the word loving kindness, and it appears in a different context in the Torah, in chapter 20, in the Sedra of the Torah of Kedoshim, Parashas Kedoshim, Leviticus, for those who look for the English quote, chapter 20, verse 17. It refers to an incestuous forbidden relationship as chesedhu. Literally, it is loving kindness. Loving kindness! And Rashi says, the commentator says, no, it means it's shameful. Just like the Aramaic word for kindness is chasuda. What does that mean? What's the shame and kindness? Yet not if you're the doer of kindness. If you perform loving kindness, that's wonderful. But if you're the recipient, it is shameful. It is robbing of dignity. It's crushing. And this is where the Gemara tells us in Bava Metzia that somebody would rather one of their own than nine of their friends. We want our own dignity. Right, this is literally, this is it. We do not want to be the recipient of somebody's kindness. Elsewhere, the rabbis call it Nahama de Chisufa, the bread of shame. It says, Lot, do you know how shameful it is that my whole life has just been being your kindness project? You may feel wonderful about yourself, but you are robbing me and all your other victims who make you feel so great of any dignity whatsoever. Do you know what it's like to go up to a potential future client and say, hi, I'm Lot, CEO of, oh yeah, you're Abraham's nephew, yeah, we'll deal with the boss. I'm a nobody. That's what you've done to me. I'm Mr. Gam in Hebrew, or in English, Mr. Also. And also Lot had all this wealth. I don't want this anymore. I want to have my dignity. I want to go into a place that knows the tyranny of the helping world, and I don't want a part of it. And Sodom is the place of self-made people, where we understand how dangerous kindness is, where we understand we don't want this world of welfare and caring and looking after and robbing humans, not letting them stand on their own two feet. We want to go there. Now, of course, Sodom is totally wrong. It's a terrible thing, and God comes in and punishes the place and destroys it, but he does rescue Lot. And the implication is Lot had a good question. He had a good point. And this point, by the way, is embedded into the psyche of the human being. It lies at the root of a lot of class warfare and class resentment. The rich saying, come on, poor guys, get on your feet. Why are we paying taxes? And the poor saying, we don't want to feel like we're dependent on recipients on you. You should pay your taxes because you've had some unfair advantage or something like that. But it's also true on the psychological relationships of any imbalanced relationship, like parents and children. That two-year-old desire to say no that makes every kid feel so proud. And it actually goes back to the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden's story. Adam sins in the garden and for the first time uses the word anoichi, the Hebrew word which is not I, indexical, aleph nun yud, meaning me, but anoichi, I assert my existential self only after sin, as if to say, "Now, till now I've been a figment of your imagination, O loving creator of the universe. Very nice, you have kindness. What am I? Just that's what I am, just an old Tom. Now I've done something that is me. I've cut you off. I'm being independent." And this is, by the way, subconsciously a huge part of the existential need to rebel against God. It's deep inside all of us. And it manifests as God tries to give the Torah to the Jewish people. In the Sedra of Yisra, the part of the Torah that describes the giving of Torah, it describes the Israelites, B'nai Yisrael, camped at the foot of Mount Sinai, that they camped B'tachti Sahar, literally underneath the mountain. And that's amazing Chazal, amazing time. The ancient rabbis tell us that, yes, Kof Aleim Har Kegigis. The Gemara says that, in fact, you could imagine the picture of God suspending the mountain over them like a barrel, saying, it felt like being forced. We don't have a choice. We're just, how do you say no to the infinite creator of the universe giving you the greatest gift? But does it feel good? Or is there a part of us that wishes to rebel against it? And this is an issue that is very deep and very raw, that kindness is also robbing people of dignity. Our relationship with God feels robbed. It almost seems to dehumanize us. And if this problem is not solved, then we will have social tensions, family tensions, national tensions, and a relationship with God issue. And we will have the rich wanting to get out of town when the famine's there. Whether they do physically or not might vary from place to place and time to time, but there'll always be that resentment. And we cannot fully integrate as a nation until we can solve this, and we cannot fully deepen our relationship with God to the highest levels and receive Torah properly until we resolve this. By the way, in the chapter itself, so what actually happens in the story here in the opening chapter of Ruth is, first of all, they go to Moab. The boys marry Moabite women. All the men in the family die. Elimelech dies. By the way, even the name Elimelech, Eli to me, Melech is kingship. Right? Think about that. It's very, very profound. It's all about self-centeredness. It's one way of there's different views on, was he good, was he not good? He seems to have at one point been the elites of the generation, maybe even the righteous. I'm not going to go into all the different commentaries. But either way, the men die. The boys have married one Ruth and her sister-in-law Orpah, and Naomi heads back to her country, back to Israel, back to Judea, back to Yehuda, and they want to come with her. And she says, "No, go back to your lands." And they say, "No, ki tochna shuvalem, we want to go back to your people." It was an amazing sacrifice. I mean, they were willing to sacrifice comforts and home and familiar lands to go all the way back. And now Naomi wants to give a speech to deter them. And here's a great exercise for you to think about. Imagine you or I, right, anyone here, or any one of you listening or watching this, had to give a speech to try to persuade them not to follow her. What would you say? "Now listen, my daughters or daughters-in-law, right? Don't come in." Why? Loads of possible reasons, right? Because here you can be looked after by your own family. You've only got me, and I'm not a landowner. You know, my husband was a landowner, but I'm not going to be much of a farmer. The town's probably taken over our properties. You're going to be poor. Here you're an insider and nobility. With me, you're going to be an outsider, right? In a town that's very hostile and suspicious and very, very much like your Moabite type of civilization. That's what we're like too. They're going to be xenophobic. You're going to be treated as a stranger and an outsider. You're never going to be able to get married and build your own home. You're giving up your whole life that you can have an amazing life set up here and trading it for a terrible life there. But she doesn't say all that. You know what she says? It's absolutely shocking. It's in chapter 1, verse 11, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Naomi says, "Shavna benoisai, go back, my daughters. Lama selach naimi, why would you travel with me?" Now listen to this. "Ha'oidli vonim b'meah, do I still have children in my womb that are going to be husbands for you?" You can just imagine them going, "Oh yeah, we never thought about that. Okay, I guess we go back." But Naomi's very serious about this argument. She actually goes, listen to what she then says. She then carries on. "Shavna benoisai, go back, my daughters. Lechna go, ki zakanti meslish, I'm actually too old to get married." That's what they're thinking. "But now, let's suppose I would have hope." Like, what's she talking about? "Let's suppose I could even marry someone tonight." Like, what's she thinking? What are they? "And maybe I could even have children." Like, you just imagine them looking at her going, "Oh, wow, she lost all her marbles. You know what's happening." Next possible. "Halahim to Sabena, what, you're going to wait around? Adashi Dolu until they grow up? Halahim to, again, you're going to become like agunas, like chained women, you know? Levilti Yisrael, not to be..." She goes, "No, I'm too bitter for you." And you think they must just smile at this point, go, do you know what, Normie, it's okay. We weren't actually planning to wait for you to have children for us to marry. We'll still go with you. And yet, amazingly, it works. These girls or young women who were willing to give up everything and go with her 1 minute ago, Oropok kisses goodbye. Something Normie said triggers a reaction. Not only does she kiss goodbye, but the next thing, Normie turns to Ruth and says, it says, Ruth stovkoba, Ruth clings on, as if there's like some kind of hurricane wind blowing against them. Oropok's been blown out of the water. Ruth is hanging on for dear life. What did these words, what chord did they strike? And so much so that Normie says, look, Oropok's gone back to El Ama, to her people, for El Eloi Herha, and to her gods. 1 minute ago, she was willing to be part of the Jewish people and give everything up. Normie says this weird thing about children, and boom, Oropok's gone. And Ruth, what does she say? Some of the famous, Sukkim, most famous verses of the whole, anywhere in Tanakh, actually. And Ruth says in verse 16, Vatomer Ruth, Al tifki bi lazvech, don't push me to abandon you. As you keep pushing, I will stop talking to you. And then she seems to say the opposite, to go away from you. Because wherever you go, I go. Shatalini onin, where you lie, I lie. Amech ami, your people are my people. Velokai chalokai, and your God is my God. Shatamusi amos, where you die, I die. Veshomekaver, and there I shall be buried. Koyasa shamli, thus may God do to me. Vekoyosif, and even more than that, kiamavas yafri beni yavenecha, as we say in Christian weddings, to death do we part. You know, but that comes from here. Only in death do we part. It's contradictory. In other words, what Normie said, and this is what Rabbi Miller brings in his book, the idea, what Normie's saying is, 1 second, girls, you are Moabites. You understand independence. Do you realize that you're probably just coming along with me because you've become so dependent upon me? Because for 10 years I've looked after you and your husbands while they were alive, and now you depend upon me? That's what's happening here, isn't it? You can't perceive reality outside of me anymore. And do you know what that means? That means, do you know how absurd it is? If you really depend on what, you're going to wait for me to have children? That's ludicrous, right? And Oropok goes, oh my goodness, you're right. I'd become somewhat dependent upon you. I can't believe this. And that's why it's such an impact. I don't want to be, I want to be independent. This is crazy, you know. And she, the Gemara says, in fact, now Oropok's descendants commit their existence to destroying Ruth's descendants of King David and everybody, and Goliath the giant who nearly kills King David and others. They're all her children. That's why she's called Horopah elsewhere in Tanakh. It's the same person, right? And this terrible, like, revolt against, literally feeling revolted by this whole process. And Ruth says, no, I'm clinging on. I'm going to resist this. Because you know what? If you push me, I will not talk to you again. I'll abandon you. But I'm going to follow you around. Because I don't need you. But I admire you. You have what I want to have. And you are what I want to become. I see greatness in you. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. And if that means your people are my people, your God is my God. By the way, amazingly enough, in the laws of conversion, both in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, it has almost a very similar point. It says that, and it goes in the Gemara in Yevamos, that if someone comes to convert to the Jewish people in Daf Mem Zayin, page 47 of the tractate Yevamos, if somebody comes and says, I want to convert to Judaism, you know what you're meant to do? You're meant to tell them about anti-Semitism. Tell them you realize that throughout the exile, till the Messianic era, there's some point in your life, your children, your grandchildren, somebody's going to suffer tremendously for being Jewish. If the person says, I don't care, I just want to come along, right, no matter what, then you accept them and start teaching them laws, and you teach them strict laws and lenient laws, and the Rambam says within the strict ones, you also teach them fundamentals of faith, don't serve idolatry, we have one God. If something, 1 second, this person just said they want to convert to Judaism, right, and they were willing to risk their life for it, and now you're telling them we don't do idols? What did they think they were doing a minute ago? Now you tell them we serve one God, what? And the answer must be like here. They looked and they saw and they say, whatever this thing Israel is, I want to be a part of it. There's something glowing in these people that seems to be carriers of a message that is so real and deep. The truth lies in my admiration for them. Let me discover. It's because we're monotheists. Monotheists? Okay, fine. Then in that case, it must be this one God. That must be the secret, right? We don't do idols. That must be, she says, wherever you go, your God, my God, your thing, my thing. I don't care what it is. You tell me whatever God you have, it must be the one that's right. In Moab, presumably Naomi wasn't outwardly doing very much about this, but Ruth is saying, you know, I don't care. What motivates me to follow your God, what motivates me to follow your people, is I see something in you. In fact, a few verses earlier, when Naomi picks up to leave town, it says about Tetzi, she gets up from the place, she leaves the place she had been. Shahisashong, where she had been. Is Pasuk Zion, Pasuk 7. She leaves the place where she had been there. Well, obviously she left the place. Why do you need to say that? Just she's going back to Israel. And that, of course, echoes one other time that phrase appears in Tanakh. And those of you familiar with the Torah will know it's, of course, Parashas Vayetze, right? In the book of Genesis, let's just find the quote here, chapter and verse is the book of beginning of Sefer Vayetze, the chapter 28, Pasuk 10. Vayetze Yaakov, and Jacob left from Beersheba to go to Choron. Just say he went to Choron, obviously he left. Says Rashi, quoting there the Medrash there, that that in fact this is a Bereshis Rabbah, a Medrash, an ancient rabbinic commentary, that when the righteous leave place, it's like the lights go out. Ponoziva, Ponoida, the beauty, the glory, the place, you felt the impact. It was an event that he left. Something's now missing. And Rashi there quotes, so we find with in the book of Ruth, that Tetzim in Amokam, when Naomi leaves the place, it's like the lights went out. And Ruth says, I noticed this. I've lived with you and I've seen what a tremendous person you are. And I understand when you got up to leave, it's like the lights of town went out, the spirituality departed. I want to be with you. I don't depend on you. I can get rid of the dependent. I can be independent. Don't worry about me. But I want to be like you. And I want to be whatever your people are. And I'll give everything up for that. No problem. And incredibly, now that she's exhibited this point, we find something remarkable. As they come back into the town, as they come back, it literally says they came at the beginning of the barley harvest, right? But just the verse, the line or so before them, right? Naomi walks into town, the town's gathered around. Now, of course, they're not speaking to her, but they're speaking about her to each other. Is this Naomi, right? Probably partially sounds like they're mocking her. She says, you know what? Don't call me Naomi, which means sweet. Call me Mara, which means bitter, because look what's happened to me. Don't be jealous of me, right? But subtext possibly is also, but talk to me, not about me. Anyway, as they walk in, she says, I went out and I came back with nothing, you know. Vatoshav Naomi, verse 22, and Naomi returned. Okay, she can return because she's been here before. Verus Hamoaviyah, and Ruth the Moabite. It emphasizes she's a Moabiyah, a Moabite. She probably felt very Moabite at that moment. A real outsider in a town that was not being hospitable. Kalosa, her daughter-in-law, Imah with her, Hashava, Mr. Moab, who returned from the fields of Moab. What? Who's that second return? Naomi returns, okay. And Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, returns from the field of Moab. Returns from the field of Moab? You can only return to somewhere you've been before. How can Ruth be returning? Naomi's returning. Where's Ruth returning? How's Ruth returning? Says the Gemara. An unbelievable thing. Says like this. It's a Medrash Rabbah. Says that back in the town of Lot, back in the town of Sodom, when the angels were saving Lot, they talked about him finding his daughters, Hanimtzais, who are to be found in Sodom. And the rabbis say this is a hint at something. What does it mean to be found? He's finding future daughters, right? This is the idea of the word finding is also used about King David. Matsasi David Avdi, I found David my servant. Heichon Matsasi, where did I find him? I found him in Sodom. What is that saying? In other words, unbelievable, that what's happening is, as Sodom is about to be destroyed, we know that the daughters are going to produce Moav. And in fact, the Gemara says that this refers specifically, these findings are Ruth and another one, Naamah, who are going to rejoin the Jewish people. What we're saying is this, when Lot left Abraham, he left with a gaping chasm in the people, in the psyche, in the entire question that threatened to undermine the meaning and purpose of everything Abraham and Avraham and the later Israel, Jewish people, Torah, God, all stand for. Loving, kindness, chesed. He left with a real problem. How does kindness not crush us? And we've been waiting for Lot to come back because we needed an answer to that question that only he could give us as the recipient of kindness. And we've been waiting centuries, maybe 800 years, for someone to come back. to address this problem. And here she is, Ruth, she who was born in Sodom, born from Lot, born from the world of Moab, the descendant culture. She's back. We've waited centuries, and she's come to supply us with the resolution that has been so urgently needed if Israel is to ever work its way back to a civilization of unity and love, able to really deeply embrace the Torah and embrace God and heal divisions and heal the giver-taker power dynamics and all this stuff. She's back. And they come at the beginning of the Harvest Festival to let us know we're now on the journey to Shavuos. And that is such an exciting first chapter. Lisa, I hope it's exciting for you. It is for me anyway. That really kind of puts into perspective the beginning of the Book of Ruth. And from there, Be'ez Hashem, Yitz Hashem, next week, we'll be able to see chapter 2 and how we begin the process of resolving all of this. That's what we're going to look at next time. I'll stay around if there's any questions.